Chief Judge Smith, and may it please the court. My name is Dan Goldberg, and I represent Michael Lowry in this appeal. District Court erred in denying the motion to suppress because the police did not have reasonable suspicion to detain Mr. Lowry on the evening in question. The police may, of course, only conduct a Terry stop when it has reasonable suspicion to do so. And there's no dispute here that Mr. Lowry was, in fact, detained. The sole question is whether there was reasonable suspicion to do so. And here there was not, and therefore the district court erred.
Counsel, could there also be an additional issue of the application of attenuation
Absolutely,
concepts
Your Honor.
And principles?
The government does maintain that the attenuation doctrine, if there is a constitutional error, any error is essentially harmless. Based on Utah Street's three-prong test, though, we maintain that the attenuation doctrine does not apply to this case. And I can go through those three factors for this court. First factor is the temporal proximity. And this one's easy. The government concedes that there's no intervening time factor. Turning to prong two, intervening circumstances. And we don't believe there's an intervening circumstance either. What the government's argument, I think, is that any time they find a warrant for someone's arrest, that somehow intervenes. But I don't think that's the case here. Here, the sole apparent purpose to stop Mr. Lowry was to run that records check. So nothing intervened.
Counsel, what does the record show about the facts that support that claim that you just made? I mean, what is in the record that establishes that the sole purpose of the stop was to run a warrant check?
I think that's a great question, Your Honor. What supports it is that here in Streep, you have a cohesive theory to detain the person. Here, there's no cohesive theory. You have conflicting theories given by Officer Hand when he's asked, why'd you stop this individual? He says, well, maybe it was drugs, maybe it was guns, maybe it was alcohol, maybe he was concealing, maybe he was discarding. And so all these things are so conflicting that even the government has to concede in their brief that Officer Hand didn't know why he was stopping Mr. Lowry. And so I think that's troubling in the sense that by all purposes, he was just sitting there waiting for the bus.
Now, does that go to the second prong of Strife, or is that the third prong you're discussing?
I think it, and I see your point, I think it does go to the third prong, but it also goes to the second prong, too, I think.
Because I think in Strife, I mean, on the third prong, we're looking for flagrant misconduct, I think is the language, and there's different language in that opinion. But I don't think a mistake about reasonable suspicion qualifies as flagrant misconduct. So again, my question is, you know, what specifically is there, and maybe this is more directed to the third prong, which you haven't addressed yet, but, you know, that seems to me to be a fairly high bar in order to hit that third issue under Strife.
Right, and I think your point's well taken. Our position is it is a fishing expedition here. All the Officer Hand is fishing for is any street cram.
Well, wouldn't it have been different if, indeed, the appellant was only sitting and still, that the facts here were such that he would get up, he'd go around behind, he'd come back, it's rainy, it's misty, it's not the sort of environment where one would generally leave cover and draw attention to yourself through movement?
I think it's a good question, Your Honor. I think the problem with the moving around in a bus stop is that it's a cold night. And so at best that's ambiguous, I think, because he could be moving around to stay warm. We don't know. And I think the inquiry into reasonable suspicion looks for the exact opposite of ambiguity, objective and particularized indicia of criminal activity. Now, if he was trying to evade police conduct, what he would have done is the first time turn around and ran away. But he didn't do that. He hung around. He was staring at Officer Hand, no doubt about it. But anyone would have stared at Officer Hand. He was screaming at a third party named Tyson Parks. Why are you here? Why are you here? He was clapping his hands very loudly, commanding everyone's attention. So I think it would have been more suspicious had Mr. Lowry not looked at Officer Hand. So I think there's a constitutional violation. And going to the question of whether and not it's purposeful and flagrant, I think the issue is that no reasonable officer would have thought that they had a basis to detain Mr. Lowry under these facts. And I think...
So if we move past that, if we, for argument's sake, accept that proposition that there really isn't reasonable suspicion at this point, then we get back to attenuation concepts. And you can proceed with your outline of addressing the Supreme Court's recent decision.
Yes, and I think... So the question becomes, they have this warrant. And the government's argument is, well, they have to arrest him because they have the warrant. And that's true. They do have to arrest him because there's that warrant. But that doesn't mean just because you have a warrant that you're cloaked in good faith if you violated someone's constitutional rights. And let me give you an example of a case that we cite in our briefs, the Lopez-Zuniga case. You have a warrant issued by a judge to put a GPS tracker on a car, and this court held that no reasonable officer could think that probable cause existed for this warrant, this specific warrant. So the good faith exception did not apply. Okay? And I think
that's... Well, this isn't good faith. This is... Streif doesn't turn on good faith. It's not the officer's good faith that it turns on. There has to be some remoteness that separates it, or, and they use the term or... an intervening circumstance. And the intervening circumstance would be locating the warrant. And once the officer sees that the person is wanted, regardless of how they got to that point, a constitutional violation that is of the nature of going over the line of reasonable suspicion, should that succeed in keeping evidence out and being an exclusion remedy, the Supreme Court said no. So get to the third prong and tell us why the third prong doesn't turn in favor of the government here.
I think not. And I think your point's a good one. Let's turn to the facts of Streif, because I think they're very important. In Streif, you have the police stopping someone after leaving a house. And why, leaving a house that was suspected of drug activity, and why do they have that suspicion? It's because there's been a tip, right? And why else do they suspect drugs or activities are going on there? They've been there for a week, and they see people coming and going, in short time intervals, all commensurate with drug activity. The only mistake made by the police, I think, is a good faith mistake, and not clocking in when that defendant left the house. Those aren't the facts here. Here you have, by all measures, Mr. Lowry simply waiting for a bus. And we should be able, and anyone that night, under the logic espoused by Officer Hinn, would have been stopped that night, could have been stopped by that night. And I understand that they are running saturation patrols at this bus stop to try to prevent crime. And the police need to do that sometimes. But they need to do so within the boundaries of the Fourth Amendment. And if they don't, I think there's a real reason to exclude the evidence here. Because otherwise you're saying people on at bus stops have lesser Fourth Amendment rights. And I think that's a troubling precedent to look at here. So
well, the language the court uses is that the warrant breaks the causal chain, and that is the rationale.
And I don't think it always does, though. I don't think Streif announces a per se rule. I think Judge Thomas uses the language fishing expedition. And if there's a fishing expedition, I don't think the warrant helps him. Let's say the police come to my house in the middle of the night without a warrant, kick down the door, come into my house, and they do a records check immediately and find that I have a warrant for my arrest. And then they find cocaine on my person. Well, I may have violated law, and they have a right to arrest me. But I also have a right to challenge the constitutionality of that search.
Well, wouldn't that go to the issue discussed in Streif of the flagrancy of the constitutional violation?
Here, right.
Stepping over the line of reasonable suspicion is a little different than kicking a door down in the middle of the night.
I think what happened here, and I see your distinction here, but what I think is flagrant and purposeful about here is that the officer comes up to the bus stop. He sees Tyson Parks, who he knows, has right to arrest and detain. He doesn't know anything about my client. He immediately says, "You come here." My client complies with that order. He said, "What'd I do?"
Well, counsel, isn't that reasonable behavior? I mean, you've got an officer involved with an escalating situation with Mr. Park or Mr. Parks. You've got a high crime area. You've got the appellant in this case who, whether or not it rises to the level of reasonable suspicion, the officer has suspicion, again, in a high crime area. It could have been just a split second. I've got this guy here. I've got him there. I need to maintain control of the situation. Now, that he may have been wrong about reasonable suspicion, but it seems to me you still need to point to how that's flagrant, because I think there's a reasonable explanation for what happened there, whatever way we find on the Terry stop.
I think this court's case law supports the notion that what happened here was a constitutional violation. And let me just cite to a case, Jones, from this court, where I think the police arguably had more basis to stop the defendant. You have a defendant who's walking down the street in the Jones case, and he's intently looking at the police cruiser driving down, staring at him. He's also clutching something in his hoodie pocket of his sweatshirt. And there's all this testimony at the suppression hearing how clutching something means something bad's going to happen, something violent. The Eighth Circuit says, sorry, just clutching something is not sufficient to show that you have reasonable suspicion, because we all clutch from time to time. And then they also, the government also argued in that case, hey, you know, the police officer was right. Something bad did happen there, and he was violating the law. The Eighth Circuit said, yeah, well, the police might have been right, but you also violated this individual's Fourth Amendment rights. And here, that's the exact same analysis I think applies here. And I think you have more egregious conduct, because I don't think that it's reasonable. Well, I think it's purposeful when you are saying, you come here, I'm detaining you, you no longer have liberty, but I don't know why. And I'm gonna, and even on hindsight vision at the suppression hearing, I'm gonna offer conflicting theories that have no basis in the record. I mean, he testified, Officer Hand did, that he didn't see him conceal or hide anything, not drugs, not guns, not weapons. If you look at the video, which is Exhibit 3, you see that the bus stop is clear. So there's this big rationale, well, he's hiding and behind the thing. Well, it's kind of hard to hide but behind a translucent bus shelter. So I think there is a basis to invoke the Fourth Amendment, and I think there is a basis to exclude this evidence. If there's no other questions, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Goldberg. Mr. Hurst?
May it please the court. Ben Hurst for the United States. I'd like to start with the reasonable suspicion issue here, and then I'll move to the attenuation issue. Following that, unless there are questions from the court, we can move a different direction. When I start with the reasonable suspicion issue, I'd like to highlight a couple of things, factors in consideration of reasonable suspicion that I think are important for the court to keep in mind in evaluating the circumstances and the district court's decision here to deny the suppression motion. First, reasonable suspicion is not preponderance of the evidence. It's not a probable cause. It's a low bar that
it's got to be more than a hunch.
Yes, Your Honor.
And in some ways, this seems a lot like a hunch.
Yes, Your Honor. I can see that we agree that a mere hunch is not going to do it. But I think here what's required is articulable facts that the officer can articulate, but he doesn't have to be able to say exactly what crime he suspects is going on. It's enough to say that there's criminal activity.
Look, counsel, if you read the district court's analysis on this issue, it basically comes down to that he walked away twice while keeping his eyes on the officer. And this was in the context of a heated exchange that was going on. That just seems to fall short of even a low bar.
Yes, Your Honor, but I think that the I don't think it falls short of the low bar. I think that the articulation from the officer here, and it has to be weighed, I think, in comparison to the intrusion, which here in this case was minimal. Come sit here and sit inside this bus shelter 25 yards away. But I do think that the The district court covers the facts, but puts them in context. In fact, the district court says this. You have to consider not just that he walked away twice while he was watching the officer, and those are factors that this court has held. Maybe they're not sufficient on their own, but that they're factors that an officer can consider when it comes to reasonable suspicion, that the opportunity or taking the opportunity to evade the officer, bringing yourself to a position where the officer can't see what you're doing, so obstructing the officer's vision. And then in the context of this case, which has already been discussed today, that it was cold. It was January 28th in Kansas City. It was windy. It was misting. And the defendant left the bus shelter, the relative comfort of the bus shelter, to go outside not once but two different times. And I think the course of events is also important here. The police cruiser pulls up, and that's the first time that Officer Hand sees the defendant leave the shelter and go behind the sort of while he's watching the police cruiser. Officer Hand gets out. He begins his interaction with Mr. Parks, and the defendant comes back around into the bus shelter. But then when the officer looks and makes eye contact with the defendant, he leaves the shelter again and goes behind it. And this is the point at which the officer, who testified, in fact, that he had seen people doing similar behavior who are later found to have committed some kind of crime, is concerned primarily with the fact that there's some kind of contraband that may be involved. Maybe it's alcohol, maybe it's drugs and narcotics, and maybe it's some kind of weapon. And that the officer knows.
Well, it sounds like a good hunch then, but it still sounds kind of iffy in terms of the strength of the suspicion of illegality.
Yes, Your Honor, but that's not everything that the officer had. The other reason the officer was there has been referred to here is that he knew and had been that this was a place where high crime had gone on, not just high crime sort of inchoate high crimes, but in fact specific kinds of crimes the officer testified had gone on at this place. So there were violent crime, fights and disturbances, issues with alcohol. In fact, that's why the interaction with Mr. Parks was an alcohol issue, and in fact testified at the hearing that an undercover or a loss prevention officer who was an off-duty police officer had observed narcotics transactions going on at the bus stop. And these are all things that the officer knew that fed into his decision just to ask Mr. Lowry to come over and talk to him. And the one additional thing about that is, and it fits both, I think, maybe less so in the reasonable suspicion, but I think it goes to the attenuation piece, is that the officer was by himself. He had another sort of probationary or temporary officer with him in the car who couldn't help out. But he was by himself. There were other people around, and he was trying to handle a situation with Mr. Parks that was escalating and that was creating his attention or dividing his attention. What the officer testifies that normally he would go directly to the pedestrian and do the pedestrian stop and sort of just talk to him.
Right. But, I mean, generally this would have led to a consensual encounter, I think.
I think that's correct.
That's what you're saying. So, and I do think that goes to the attenuation issue, but I don't think it solves your problem on reasonable suspicion. I mean, the standard is what the standard is. And I think I just heard you say that generally the officer would not have believed or would not have conducted a Terry stop. But in this case, he did, and that's the part that I'm having trouble with, I think.
Yes, Your Honor, and I can see that issue, and I do agree that it goes to, in fact, one factor in this case that makes it actually a little stronger case for the application of the attenuation doctrine than Streif, because the court in that case said, well, how was the officer negligent? In this case, it doesn't rise to misconduct. It's not flagrant. But what did he do? Well, it was mere negligence not to do a walk and talk, not to approach a pedestrian. Here, we actually don't have, I think, that kind of negligence that they had in that case. And it does go in that point to a greater reason from the government's perspective to apply the attenuation doctrine. But I'll just one or two more things to mention about reasonable suspicion. The officers is not required to rule out all the innocent explanations. Certainly there are innocent explanations here, but that's not the standard. The standard is, taking all of the totality of the circumstances together, not the divide and conquer analysis where you look at each piece and say, well, that doesn't meet the standard, that doesn't meet the standard, that doesn't meet the standard, but taking everything together, did the officer get, does he have an articulable suspicion based on specific facts that criminal activity is afoot? And in this case, the government thinks that that standard is met. And the fact that you don't have to rule out innocent explanations is sort of baked into the reasonable suspicion analysis. Reasonable suspicion, Terry stops, the Fourth Amendment acknowledges that sometimes you're going to lawfully stop someone who, and you're not going to find evidence of crime or criminality. It's not going to develop out of that. So I think with that, I'll move to a fuller discussion of the attenuation doctrine unless the court has additional questions about reasonable suspicion. With respect to the attenuation doctrine, I think that the case that we've all been discussing, the Streiff case, is really kind of on all fours with this case. I don't think, because I think that it's true, the temporal prospect here, the intervention of the knowledge of the independent warrant is as close or no closer anyway than it was in a Streiff case, but that was a case where the court said, yes, this counsel's in favor of suppression, but we're not going to suppress the evidence because the other two factors are stronger. So I think in considering the other two factors, was there an intervening circumstance? Yes. The intervening circumstance here and the intervening circumstance in Streiff are both very similar. In that case, there was he approached and stopped the person who at that point didn't have reasonable suspicion to stop, and he said, got his ID, ran his ID, and determined that he had an active warrant. The active warrant had nothing to do with the officer's prior evidence for why he was stopping that person, and that's what made it independent and what made it an intervening cause. And we have that same kind of thing here where the warrant that was intervening is not a warrant that the officer even knew was there and didn't have anything to do with the interaction that was going on at the bus stop. So I think the cause is intervening. My colleague says that the factual difference in Streiff, considering the fact that it was a drug case or the fact that there was a stronger facts maybe supporting the analysis or the investigation in that case, I think that's not a piece of the analysis. When attenuation comes up, it is coming up because we know that there wasn't enough suspicion or probable cause to justify what was done before. That's why we're talking about attenuation. Now, that's not the government's position here, but for the sake of argument. So the fact that that case was involved a house where there was maybe drug transactions going on and this involved a bus stop, I don't think it's a relevant point to the analysis. The point is, when he found and stopped the defendant, and saw that the defendant had an active warrant that was not related to what was going on before, he had an obligation to arrest the defendant, and it was a search incident to that arrest that revealed the evidence of the crime that we're discussing here. So that covers the intervening circumstances prong. The last prong, the flagrancy of the purposefulness of the misconduct. The government doesn't think that there was evidence in the record to that Officer Hand was stopped Mr. Lowry solely for the purpose of determining who he was so that he could run a check in his computer. If the officer made a mistake here, I think it was a reasonable one. The government's position is, in fact, that he didn't make one, but in any event, it was a close call. If he missed the reasonable suspicion because there wasn't quite enough there, it was no more than negligence from the government's perspective, and I think that brings us squarely within the context of what the court in Streiff held was not flagrant misconduct. I don't think that there was anything like a fishing expedition. Streiff does talk about the possibility that there might be systemic or recurring police misconduct. I don't think that there's any evidence in the record that would support that in this case. There's some suggestion in the reply brief that maybe the purposefulness analysis goes to the act that the officer did. I don't think that's what Streep is talking about. Every arrest is purposeful in that sense, or most everyone is going to be, the officer is going to be purposefully arresting the person. Like, they mean to stop them. They mean to conduct the Terry stop. They mean to conduct the arrest. I think the purposefulness, when what Streep is talking about with purposefulness, is a question of the purposefulness as to the violation. Is the violation so obvious? Is the officer going in there with the purpose, knowing that he's going to violate the Fourth Amendment, to do so? I don't think that's what we have here. I think Officer Hands, the circumstances are not such that it would suggest that there was some kind of purposefulness to the violation of the Fourth Amendment, if there was one. I do think it's important to recognize that flagrancy of misconduct is not just the absence of reasonable suspicion or probable cause. That's what the court says there. And I think if that were true, then there wouldn't be a need for an attenuation doctrine, because every case that involves where the officer has reasonable suspicion or probable cause, there wouldn't be a need to do the attenuation analysis. I'm going to discuss Jones briefly, unless there's another attenuation question. My colleague mentioned Jones. I just want to highlight that I don't think Jones is that close to what we have here. In Jones, there was the defendant watched the officers, but there was no flight, there was no evasion, there was no attempt to move away from the officers or get up away from the officers' view.
Well, there wasn't that here. He didn't leave. He could have left. He went behind the bus stop, he came back, went behind it again, he came back. He never left. When he was called to come, he obeyed the officer's direction.
Yes, Your Honor. With the caveat or the qualification, the officer did testify that his view was obstructed of the defendant when the defendant went behind the shelter.
Counsel, there was an altercation that the officer was involved in, talking about innocent explanations. If I was waiting at a bus stop, for example, I'm watching an incident going on that could turn violent, there's an easy, innocent explanation, I think, for stepping away while keeping your eyes on the situation but not wanting to get too close.
Yes, Your Honor. I think that would be, we'd have a different case here if all that had happened was that the defendant had watched what was going on. I think that would be a different case than the one we have. But the one we have is one where the defendant, who is already 25 yards away, makes the additional step to go behind and get away from the vision of the officer, and does so twice in circumstances where doing so was putting him at some kind of discomfort.
That assumes that the conduct was done to avoid the vision of the officer.
Yes,
Your Honor. It had the effect of the officer not being able to see him. But that has to assume that the purpose for going behind was to avoid the officer's vision. There could be any number of reasons that one would have made that action without attempting or without having the purpose of being unseen by an officer who's engaged with someone else at the moment.
And then choosing to be seen again. And then choosing to be seen again.
Yes, Your Honor. I think I'll handle both questions. As to your question, Your Honor, I don't think that that the officer was required to get reasonable suspicion to explain, to deal with all innocent explanations for the behavior. Yes, there are innocent explanations, but he doesn't have to. We consider the totality of the circumstances, not just that one factor in the officer. Reasonable explanations, he doesn't have to rule them all out. And with respect to yours question, Your Honor, I think that what the explanation I think might be is that when he left the first time, then the officer engaged with Mr. Parks, and then he came back around. That's my understanding of what happened. And then when the officer looked at him again, that's when he went back behind again. I see my time has expired. If there are no other questions, I'll...
Thank you, Mr. Hurst.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Goldberg, your rebuttal.
I think this case does turn on the attenuation doctrine, and I just disagree with my colleague that Streep is on all fours here.
Counsel, the district court didn't, as I recall, address attenuation. if we determine it should be addressed, is it appropriate for us to address it, or would a remand be appropriate for the district court to take a look at that issue?
Well, I do think that typically this court is a court of first, or not of review, not first view. So I think a remand would be appropriate. I do think based on these facts, though, my thought is that the attenuation doctrine ought not apply. But if the court found it helpful, I think the remand should occur. I think the problem here, though, is that it goes back to the notion that the facts, obviously. You've got Mr. Lowry there looking at Tyson Parks. The officer feels threatened by Tyson Parks. That doesn't give him a basis to detain everyone at the bus stop. And you see this rationale by Officer Hand on the stand. He says, well, he was wearing bulky clothing. It was a cold night. You know, so every one of his rationales is defeated. And let's say we were leaving this courtroom today, this courthouse, and everyone's being stopped for records checks, every single one of us. Does that intervene? Is that an intervening circumstance when they find warrants?
But that's a fishing expedition, right?
Right.
I mean, that's a little different. That's very different than what we have in this case.
Well, Judge, I just respectfully disagree, because when you're at a bus stop and you're not doing anything wrong besides walking around, I don't think that's a basis to stop someone, especially when the officer's justification is that he's fishing for street crime. He could have said, well, I thought he was engaged in child porn and wire fraud and having a gun. All those theories become so conflicting that I think it becomes evidence that it is, in fact, a fishing expedition. Unless there's other questions, we respectfully submit this matter be reversed and remanded and the motion suppressed be granted.
Thank you, Mr. Goldberg. Thank you, too, Mr. Hurst. Thank you for the arguments you provided to the court. I think it will be helpful as we try to resolve the issues presented. And we'll take your case under advisement. You may be excused.